So you can open your Bibles to Nehemiah chapter 2. So last week we actually looked at Nehemiah, the beginning of the book, a little bit of background. Again, as I mentioned in the first topical two studies we did about Nehemiah, I gave a little bit of background and combined with yesterday that provides, I think, a lot of information about the book, about Nehemiah, about the man. And one of the things that is, again, important to mention and noteworthy is that he was a cupbearer to the king, Artaxerxes. And we see that all this is happening in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes as he is serving the king. And as he is there in Susa or Shusha, depends on translation, which was one of the major cities in Medo-Persian Empire, specifically used by kings during winter months. Also, is very important city when you think in a biblical perspective, is that Nehemiah is in Shusha when these things happen. Esther is in Shusha when the whole story of Esther kind of transpires and happens. And so it becomes very, very important biblical city for that matter. And a lot of important things that relate to the Jewish nation and the people and the land happen in this city. So it's one of those cities that we can kind of are a little bit more favorable towards the Jewish nation. Like, for example, you think of Babylon or you know, think of Nineveh, for example. Those cities were enemy cities that brought a lot of pain and suffering and trouble to the Jewish nation. This one has a better connotation, like a better sound to it when it relates to the Jewish people. Now, I think that it's important again to mention he was a cupbearer to the king. And as he is there in Susa, he hears the reports about the state of Jerusalem, how it is in desperate state. Ezra, in previous years, as he went and took some of the people with him, they tried to rebuild the walls, but that was not successful. There was almost a ban put on their building efforts. And so upon hearing the state, he had this awesome prayer that we looked at last week. And now we pick up in chapter 2, starting in verse 1. This is right after the prayer that he had. And he says, And it came to pass in the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was before him, that I took the vine and gave it to the king. Now I had never been sad in his presence before. Therefore the king said to me, "Why is your face sad, since you are not sick? This is nothing but sorrow of heart." So I became dreadfully afraid, and I said to the king, "May the king live forever. Why should my face not be sad when the city, the place of my father's tombs, lies waste, and its gates are burned with fire?" So a few informations about this time. First of all, he tells us this is happening in the month of Nisan, which is opposite of the we see in the chapter 1, was month of Kislev. Now, month of Nisan would be 4 months after the events of chapter 1, verse 1, and this is March, April time for us. And it says that it's 20th year. If you remember, if you take kind of a 4 months before this, the Kislev or Chislev is November, December. Now, it says that then that month was 20th year. And in this case, it says it's 20th year of King Artaxerxes. And that's because they didn't begin to count the years of king's reign until September, October period. So that will be, until it reaches September, October, that will move to the next year rather than January, as you know we would kind of tend to think of. So that's when it comes to the time. So there's 4 months break between chapter 1 and chapter 2, which obviously gives a lot of time for Nehemiah to pray, a lot of time for Nehemiah to think, possibly plan, work on things, whatever. And one thing that is interesting, the way chapter 2 happens, he tells us, and it came to pass in the month of Nisan, and tells us when wine was before the king. Meaning, He was about his business. He was doing what he was expected to do. He was a king's cupbearer. As a cupbearer, his duty was to drink the wine that was served to the king, so that if it was poisonous, he would die first, and then therefore king's life would be spared. But if it's not, then he can freely himself serve the king. Meaning in that sense, he was a trusted servant to the king. But what's interesting about it is that as he is being serving the king, 4 months later, so 4 months, he's been having this burden of Jerusalem and his people on his heart. Now, there's no need to assume that he didn't appear before king at any time between chapter 1 and 2. But at this time, as just the language kind of gives a hint, it just happened to be this day, the heaviness of the burden was upon him so much that he could not hide it in his face. It was obvious that he was sad. Now, I think all of us know that. There's times when you're sad, when you're not good, when you can hide it. People just can't tell. You can hide it well because you don't want to share it. But then there's times when you're just not doing well, and there's nothing. No smiles, no kind of a positive answers can hide the fact that there's something deep going on within your own heart, your own soul. And this was the case with Nehemiah. Now, as we read this, King asks him, why are you sad? King can tell that this is not, oh, you're sick, therefore you're not looking well. This is sorrow of heart. Now, this is a problematic thing for Nehemiah. Why so? Well, for a lot of reasons. One of the reasons is that it was not allowed for any servant to the king to have a sad countenance before the king, because that would communicate dissatisfaction with the king. So ultimately, it would be a sign of treason. So if you were sad before the king, the first assumption would be, you don't like me. But everybody has to like the king. If you know anything about Medo-Persians, if you look, for example, at the times of Daniel, Esther, and even now Nehemiah, one of the things that becomes clear is that there's no messing around with the king. You don't fool around with the king. You always have to be happy. You have to please him. You always have to say the right things. And so Nehemiah gets sad, and King asks him, I can tell you're sad. So the first reaction of Nehemiah is very understandable. He says, I became dreadfully afraid. Not just afraid. This is not like, oh, I'm uneasy. This is, I'm fearing for my life. And I think that's important to see, because we understand from kind of reading, as he will offer the answers following, that it will almost kind of seem like, well, he just was, everything was prepared and ready for him. He was just kind of waiting for a moment. And that may be the case. What he was not waiting for is to have it be at this time. Again, 4 months have passed. Maybe he has prayed throughout this time upon hearing the reports from Jerusalem, Lord, give me an opportunity. Lord, give me an opportunity. Lord, give me an opportunity. And he was kind of gearing himself up for possible an opportunity. And this day is probably one of those days when he was totally not expecting it. He was just about his business, and he could not even realize that he was sad before the king. There was no preparation, from what we read in this description, in his heart and in his mind, that at this day he will come before the king with a request. Because once he's caught, fear kicks in. Understandably so. Because the next sentence from the king can be, off.
Off of your head.
You're gone. But what it is interesting is that King does ask him a question. So that's a first sign of, not necessarily favor, but an opportunity. And upon hearing the question of a king, it seems kind of a, not in a way strange, but I do find it fascinating that he answered it this way. He says, why should my face not be sad? Ultimately, he is saying to the king, before whom he is not allowed to be sad, I have to. There's no other way for me to express how I feel except sadness. And it almost seems he is speaking to the king in a rough way, but I think he's speaking very tactfully to the king nonetheless. Because notice what he says and what he does not say. So first of all, he says, when the city, and he doesn't say which city it is. He says the city, which will obviously he thinks of Jerusalem, but he's not saying to the king which city he means. The place of my father's tombs lies waste. Again, he doesn't specify which city is in question, not even a nation that he is referring to. Which might give us a hint that he was similar, maybe, I'm just guessing here, to Mordecai, who hid from his employers, the king, that he was a Jewish man. Just like he encouraged Esther to keep it quiet, that she was a Jewish woman. So it's possible that the king was not fully aware of Nehemiah's background. Maybe he was. But I find it fascinating that he does not mention the city's name, nor the nation. But what he does mention is something that will be very dear to the king's heart. And that is, he says, I'm sad because of my city where the tombs of my fathers are. He's appealing to the respect that people had for the dead, the ancestors, those who were before them. And he's a very tactical approach, I think, from Nehemiah's kind of a side of things. And he would be tactical by default because he already worked for the king. So he already had some sense of knowing how to talk before the king in the first place. And obviously from the dance for me, kind of live forever, that was the first thing you always had to say. But the way he just expresses himself, I find fascinating. He says, my city, the city of my father's tombs. And this is what the king could relate to. Okay, this is, yeah, this is a big deal. Lies waste. Ultimately saying, where I'm from, people that I'm from, everything that we are is in ruins. And as a king, and somebody who has that background, as people who valued their background, that obviously would bother him as well. And so he mentions the city of my fathers, and then he adds, that gates are burned with fire. Ultimately, just expressing, look, that the city where I'm from is pretty much non-existent. It lies in ruins. And so I think to Nehemiah's surprise, we read in verse 4, then the king said to me, what do you request? So I prayed to the God of heaven. And I said to the king, if it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in your sight, I ask that you send me to Judah, to the city of my father's tombs, that I may rebuild it. Now, again, Nehemiah had 4 months of prayer, some sense of preparation, of thinking of things, not necessarily maybe thinking that he would be the one who would do things, but maybe hoping that he would be the one. But he could not prepare for this circumstance that was at one hand a life-threatening situation, to another hand became an opportunity. And I think there's sometimes an important lesson, because sometimes in our lives, what may seem like a bad thing, Lord can open up as an opportunity for something great and awesome to happen. Because just a few moments ago, Nehemiah's life was in danger. Now, a door of opportunity is opened before him. And King asks him a very surprising question. What do you request? He doesn't ask, why is that so, or any of that. It's almost as King suspected that Nehemiah had something in his mind. Now, as he asked him this question, we see that Nehemiah prays to God. And from the answer, it will already seem to us that he had some ideas in mind what he wanted to ask. So what did he pray for? I think one of the things that he prayed for is wisdom in how to present his request before the king. Again, he is dealing with ultimately the ruler of the world at this point, who can easily take his life even at this point. But he also has to speak to him in a respectful way as the one who has the authority. And so he starts to say, if it pleases the king. And that is something that I find fascinating. Because it's not just that he is saying, well, I need this. He says, fully respectful to the king, if it pleases you, if you find it in your heart, can you do this for me? Again, he just because the door of an opportunity has opened to him, he is not being assuming that now he can speak any way he wants to. He's still submitting to the authority of the king. He is still respecting his authority. And he is still treating him as the one in authority. Even though ultimately we see that Nehemiah trusts God, that God is in control and authority over all things. But he honors the ruler that he stands before. And so he prays and God gives him wisdom. I think gives him strength and gives him boldness to make this important kind of a request. And he says, if it pleases, if I have favor, I ask. Very good lesson how to tactfully talk to people at times in difficult situations. Now, notice that he says, he at the end kind of the sentence says, my desire is to rebuild it. That's what I'm requesting. Now, in this request, he also mentions the country, Judah. The king already knows, now gets the idea, where is it from? But he didn't say that at first. He made an appeal, found a way, a kind of a common ground to relate to the king. Once king was open to speak to him, now he starts to reveal a little bit more of the needs. And then so as he goes on, and we read in verse 6, then the king said to me, the queen also sitting before him, how long will your journey be, and when will you return? So it pleased the king to send me, and I set him a time. Now, what is interesting about this, well, before we actually kind of go into that, notice that it says that the queen was present. That's unique. What I mean by that, it will give us a hint that this was more of a private event, so to say. This is king with a queen and not many other people. This is not a formal gathering. Again, if you are familiar with Esther, you remember when Queen Ahasuerus had a feast, queen was not there. She had a feast for the women. It was separate. It would be a rare occasion to have a queen present at an official public appearance of a king. It would usually be kind of a private thing that the queen and the king. That's why Esther's request to appear before the king was so important, because she would be breaking all protocol of appearance before the king. So this gives us a hint. This was not a lot of people. It was not some kind of a formal gathering, but rather something more private. So he gives us that hint that this was he was with the queen. So he mentions that. He tells us that the question is asked, how long will your journey be? And so Nehemiah gives him his estimate. We don't necessarily know what was Nehemiah's answer, but the queen wanted to know. King wanted to know. Why? Well, because he wanted him back. He obviously was satisfied with his work. If he wasn't, he would just say, okay, here you go. Good travels and don't come back. But that's not the case. And he set him a time. So we read in verse 7, furthermore, I said to the king, if it pleases the king, letters be given to me for the governors of the region beyond the river, that they must permit me to pass through till I come to Judah, and a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he must give me timber to make beams for the gates of the citadel, which pertains to the temple, for the city wall, and for the house that I will occupy. And king granted them to me according to the good hand of God upon me. So a few things to notice here. First, this phrase, if it pleases the king. This is actually appears to be a common way of requesting something from a ruler. So for example, look at Esther 1:19, 3:9, 5:4, 7:3, 8:5, and 9:13 have the same phrase when they are addressing the king. If it pleases the king. If it pleases the king. If it pleases the king. So it seems to be some form of a protocol that Nehemiah is appealing to. And then he goes in and simply lays out what he was probably planning all time. His desire was to go to Jerusalem, obviously. And so this is something that he already had prepared. Not how the event came to be and all the circumstances around it, but he knew what he wanted to request if the opportunity was given to him. And why do I seem that? Because it seems like, but he mentions Asaph, for example, who is over King's forest, the ruler. He knows his name. Now, as a king's cupbearer, it really wouldn't be his job to know who this man is. Probably never even met him. Maybe. Hard to say. But he seemed to have done some of his homework. He's done research, acquired enough information, all the things that he would need, probably familiar with the previous attempts and how previous endeavors have happened as the Jews were traveling back into the land. Challenges that, for example, Ezra had and so forth. And so he now goes and says, I simply need letters that will grant me safe passing through the land. Secondly, that it will grant me ability to go to forests and get timber I need to build. And he tells specifically what he plans, obviously for the wall, but also for the house he's going to stay in, the citadel that's attached to the temple, which is kind of a significant. He wants to invest in that. And so he is laying out before King everything that, you know, he needs. And the fact that, you know, King gives him a permission is a miraculous thing nonetheless. But that's important, biblically speaking, because from this point on, the time frame or the clock, a prophetic clock starts to tick again. Which, what am I talking about? Well, Daniel chapter 9, in Daniel 9, we have the prophecy of the 70 weeks. And there in that prophecy, so let's go there actually, so we kind of have an idea what we're talking about. There, Daniel is given a vision about the 70 weeks. And so in chapter 9, verse 24, we read the following. I'll give you a few moments to open there. Verse 24, Daniel 9. 70 weeks are determined for your people and for your holy city. Speaking to Daniel, so who is he speaking about? Prophecies regards Jews and Jewish holy city, which will be Jerusalem. To finish the transgression, to make an end of sins, to make reconciliation for iniquity, to bring an everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. So obviously dealing with the coming Messiah, the ultimate we will call millennium, the reign of Messiah on the earth. Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the command to restore and build Jerusalem. So this is the key. This, you underline this and you write Nehemiah 2:8. Next to it. This is when King Artaxerxes gives a permission to rebuild the city of Jerusalem. And this prophecy was about 95 years prior to this. And this prophecy was issued on March 5th, 444 BC. And then as you kind of start following the Daniel timeline, you will get to exact date of Christ's triumphal entry into Jerusalem and so forth. Now, I'm not going to go into Daniel's prophecy right now as much as I wanted, just to get your attention to the connection here. And so this initiates the beginning of this prophecy that there will be 70 weeks. And again, I'm not doing Daniel. We did that before. But this is that beginning. And this is what's significant. And I love how sometimes there's these verses in the scriptures, just one, very simple one, that at times may seem very, well, insignificant. It's like, oh yeah, But it's so important, scripturally speaking. And so, he is given permission. He has king's blessing. He has letters from the king. He has the authority from the king to go ahead. And so he goes ahead. And so we read in verse 9. Then he went to the governors in the region beyond the river and gave them the king's letters. Now the king had sent captains of the army and horsemen with me. When Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official heard it, they were deeply disturbed that the man had come to seek the well-being of the children of Israel. Now, so we see Nehemiah telling us what's going to happen. What's happening. As he's traveling, he is giving letters to these governors and regents, assuring them that he has the authority and right, that everything's okay. He's passing through, has his mission. How much time did it take him? Most assume that he took probably the shortest route possible to Jerusalem, which with the entourage and everything considered, it will probably take him about 2 months to get to Jerusalem. While Ezra, for example, if you look at Ezra 7, 8 and 9, took about 4 to 5 months to accomplish. Now, Ezra's circumstance was significantly different than Nehemiah's. And so, what is interesting I do find here is that as he is traveling, King also gives him an army to go with him. And that's talk about favor. He didn't request this. He was just given by the king as a sign of protection predominantly, because I'm sure at some point somebody told to the king, oh yeah, that area is kind of volatile, there's all sorts of things, it would be good that he has a protection. So the protection was given to him to reach Jerusalem. Now, Nehemiah, when you consider this, so here's the report, there's about 4 months, now possibly 2 more months, so let's say 6 months have passed from events of chapter 1 to this point. And in the last 2 months, things have become very favorable for Nehemiah. You know, A, his life was spared. But secondly, he got more than he asked for. And he could recognize, God blessed me. This was God's doing. Even though King was doing this, he recognized that God was behind all this. God was in control. God was providing. And he got more than he asked for. And so he could look and this, wow, I'm traveling and I have these letters and now I'm reaching these regions, meeting these governors, and I'm having a safe travel. It could have been easy for Nehemiah to get a wrong impression of a blessing. And what I mean by that, there's times when Lord is, as always, good to us, but we experience more good things happening to us. And all of a sudden, we can kind of assume, because of how things are going so well, that somehow it will go as well. Because the Lord is behind us. He's with us and things are going to happen. And so it's easy to assume or to think that there won't be great opposition. Then in verse 10, he introduces us with what will be not just an opposition, but continual source of opposition to Nehemiah and the whole work of rebuilding Jerusalem and its walls. One is Sanballat and the other one is Tobiah. Sanballat says the Horonite. He might have been from a town called Beth Horon, which is about 15 miles northeast of Jerusalem. In one of the historical records in called Elephantine Papyri, which is from 407 BC, mentions him as a governor of Samaria. And so he was obviously aware of the letter, because if he was a governor, remember Nehemiah is giving letters to these governors. As a governor, he gets this letter and he is distressed. He doesn't like the Jews. Most likely doesn't like the Jews. Maybe he has a plan to somehow incorporate it within his own. Maybe he was thinking he was in charge of it. Now he knows that he will be losing power and influence over the people. And that bothers him. And then we see Tobiah the Ammonite from Ammon, obviously, who were obviously descendants of Lot. And Then there will be a third guy that we will encounter very soon. But they were disturbed. And why were they disturbed? It's because somebody came to do something good for the Jews. And I find this fascinating. You know, for well-being of the children of Israel, as Nehemiah puts it here. Isn't it fascinating that historically speaking, that this has been so true for centuries, even up to this day, that Jews have been so hated throughout centuries, and hatred towards them was always justified by somebody for whatever reason, made up stories and so forth. But this idea that somebody was seeking the well-being of the Jews, and it's true today. If you dare to support the Jewish people, if you're not anti-Semite, it's actually not a popular thing. Sadly, we kind of find, I would say disappointingly, in the Western world, more and more people are openly anti-Semitic. More and more politicians are getting elected in Europe, in US, in Canada, who are anti-Semitic. And to be somebody who dares to say, you know, I desire well-being for the children of Israel, well, they're not going to look well upon you either. But I think that's important as well as Christians, as a church, to have a position on. And that is that we desire the well-being of Israel and the Jewish people. And so we continue to read in verse 11. So I came to Jerusalem and I was there 3 days. Then I arose in the night, I and a few men with me. I had told no one what my God had put in my heart to do at Jerusalem, nor was there any animal with me except the one on which I rode. So he gives us a little bit of information as he reaches Jerusalem. Now, obviously, people were aware that he was there, but nobody knew why he was there. And I'm sure they were wondering, why was this guy doing here? Because remember, he has an entourage of soldiers with him. So it's not like they didn't know he was present. But he spends 3 days pretty much not doing much. I would dare to say that most likely what he was doing was praying and planning. That's pretty much it, what he was most likely doing at this time. And so he spends time without any major activity for 3 days. And he might have talked with some people, got an idea, get a sense of how things are going on and hear the stories. But then he decides to do something, obviously in secret, because he's doing it at night. Now remember, Jerusalem is not a protected city at this point because it has no walls, it has no gates. There's no point to have a protection because the major protection is not existent. And so he gets up, in a sense, with these men, and he goes on a survey. So we read verse 13, and I went out by night through the valley gate to the serpent well and the refuse gate, and viewed the walls of Jerusalem which were broken down and its gates which were burned with fire. Then I went to the fountain gates and to the king's pool, but there was no room for the animal under me to pass. So I went up in the night by the valley and viewed the wall. Then I turned back and entered by the valley gate, and so I returned. I'll give you that paper to look at. That's how Jerusalem looked like in the time of Nehemiah. So you're going to get the idea of these locations as we're reading. But just as you wait, the valley gate is the southwest wall, east of the serpent's wall. And again, that will make more sense as you see the map. Dung gate is the southeast part of the city. Some also think that it's possibly the potsherd gate mentioned in Jeremiah 19. Fountain gate was north of a dung gate, king's pool, maybe the same as pool of Siloam, which was near the king's garden. We read that in Nehemiah 3:15, for example. We'll see that. And so he ultimately, what he's doing, he's kind of surveying the ruins of the city. He's going around telling us his location, and then he kind of reaches the king's pool. It gives us a hint that there was so much ruins there that he had a hard time passing. So that he went up by the valley, he tells us, and that might be Kidron Valley, which is east of the city. And then he goes back to the beginning place of the Valley Gate. So it's just kind of a, he gives us just information of his survey, how he went through the night and kind of observing the state of the walls and the city. And he tells us again in verse 16, and the officials did not know where I had gone or what I had done. I had not yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, or the others who did the work. Now, it's interesting that he tells us he chose to keep it a secret. There's lots of possible reasons. You know, it could be he just didn't want the word to get out there yet. It wasn't the time. He maybe didn't want to be influenced by the opinions of others as he is surveying, you know, to get input and get distracted at what he believed he was called to do. And so forth. It's hard to tell. But he chose not to tell them. And he decides at this kind of a point now to do tell them, reading verse 17. And it says, then I said to them, and them would be the priests, the nobles, the officials involved. But also just in verse 16 again, notices or others who did the work. Now, it's kind of interesting to, does he referring the others who did the work, those who will end up doing the work, or is he referring to those who were trying to do the work originally? Remember I mentioned there was eventually a ban by the king that happened as they tried to rebuild the walls and there was resistance. And so they were trying, but they were just not succeeding. It's kind of hard to tell. There's a difference of opinion on this. Nonetheless, in verse 17, then I said to them, you see the distress that we are in. Now Jerusalem lies waste, and its gates are burned with fire. Notice how often this phrase, burned with fire, is repeated. Come and let us build a wall of Jerusalem, that we may no longer be a reproach. And I told them of the hand of my God, which had been good upon me, and also of the king's words that he had spoken to me. So they said, let us rise up and build. Then they set their hands to this good work. Now, I will come back to this good work a little bit later on. But a few things to notice. First, he lays out to them, you guys are aware, the state, obviously, of the city and the reproach they were in. And they were obviously aware of it. They were the ones living in it. They were the ones who were not succeeding in rebuilding it. But he encourages them by reminding them, look where it is, but then consider this. And he tells them how God was favorable. And notice that he puts God first, even though this happened with the king and so forth. He acknowledges that God was with him at first place. And then he reports how the king was involved in all this. You know, at no point Nehemiah is blind to reality. And that is the spiritual reality. That God is in control and that he uses the human vessels, believers or unbelievers, to achieve his goals. And he shares that with them. And obviously upon hearing how all this has happened, that the king gave him so much favor, and they've seen the army come at him and all this, they recognize, yeah, something is going on. He finds right words, obviously, to say to them, to encourage them. And they go, let's work. And this is, to me, fascinating. These people were discouraged. There was no hope for them in many ways. They kept trying, but they were constantly failing. And now you have this guy show up and says, God is with me. I know it. I know it. He shares with them. He shares ultimately probably the vision with them. And they go, yes. They understood. They understood that God was with him. They understood that Nehemiah was to be the leader. And that's something that they obviously were lacking. And so they rallied behind him. And, you know, this is true. There are times when the only reason why there's no progress among God's people is because there's no leaders to lead. And when there is somebody willing to lead, God will achieve a work. And so they get set their hands to this good work. Now, we read, as it is always the case, when God starts to work and people of God are about God's business. Verse 19, but when Sanballat the Horonite, Tobiah the Ammonite official, and Geshem the Arab, so this is the third guy, and this Geshem only would appear a few times, so he doesn't seem to be the major obstacle to them, a major enemy he is. He will appear in chapter 6 in particular, but he is not involved in every resistance per se. So the Sanballat and Tobiah are the main guys, and they got this Geshem the Arab to join them. They laughed at us and despised us and said, "What is this thing that you are doing? Will you rebel against the king?" So the enemies, we see them there at work. The enemy is always at work when God is at work, especially when God's people are desiring to start the work. You know, it's not like the enemy comes at the time when you're doing the work. He will start the time when you are about to begin. Even at the start, he wants to stop you. And notice the kind of the first line of attack is the ridicule. You really? Kind of putting them down. You? Kind of idea, look at yourself. You think you can do something? And the second line of attack is the questioning the work. What are you doing? You gonna do this? You think you can do this? And the third line is the accusations, the false accusations. Are you rebelling against king? Are you gonna challenge his authority? They obviously are not. But that's what the enemy does. He laughs at us. He ridicules the idea that we will dare to do anything for him, and there will be then false accusations as you start to do things for the king. And you know what's interesting? When you think specifically of this accusation, will you rebel against the king? That's false. Absolutely. Sanballat knew. He has the letters from the king. This is king's order. He has a king's blessing. But that's what the enemy does. He brings false accusations against God's people. And you look throughout the history, and I mean, let's just stick to the history of the church. One of the most common things in persecution is the false accusations. A false narrative that goes out in the culture so that the culture will accept the persecution of the church. Nero, burning of Rome, blamed it on Christians so that he could go and start the massive execution of Christians. And just go throughout history, that's what's found. And in churches today, for example, in most places where Christians are persecuted is by government. There's some places where it's not necessarily by authorities, but authorities allow it. But in places where it is, Christianity and church is presented as the enemy of the state. That they're rebelling against the authority. That's in sadly in China and in modern times, that's one of the things we see a lot. Is the accusation that somehow the church as it grows, it will become in power and influence against the ruling party. Which is not true. By no means at any point Chinese Christians are interested in overruling the or turning, the rule of the Communist Party. Now, they don't necessarily like the communism, that's true. But they're not driven by overturning them, right? And I think that's something we see today by those who are anti-church, anti-Christian. They want to pass laws that they know that we as Christians, if the laws get passed, we can't obey in good conscience because we are obedient to God. And if we cannot obey the law of the land, because it goes against the conscience, against our obedience to the word, then they can justify Christians being imprisoned, Christians being persecuted, creating the idea that the church and believers are anti-government, anti-people, because we are against the laws. It's just the tactic of the enemy. It always was. And it will be as long as enemies around. This false accusations. And it's something that we know that for Jesus was the common thing. Falsely accused at the trial. Throughout. But one thing that we can learn from Jesus in that and from Nehemiah is that we don't allow the lies to distract us from our work. So we see, he says, "So I answered them and I said to them, the God of heaven himself will prosper us. Therefore we, his servants, will arise and build. But you have no heritage or right or memorial in Jerusalem." Gives a little bit of hint to one of some of their motives and claims. They wanted to claim to Jerusalem, which they had no rights to claim. But notice Nehemiah is not distracted by these things. He understood the good work was upon them. This was a distraction. This was an aim of the enemy to take Nehemiah's eyes off God and place it on circumstances, place it on the enemy. That's what enemy desires when he wants to distract us. He wants us to put our eyes on him, not on the Lord. When we face difficulties, he wants us to look at our difficulties rather than the Lord's. You know, when you're engaged in things of God, if you want to pursue God, what is your focus? It's on him. But the challenge that the enemy brings in front of us is the desire behind it is to get our eyes on the challenge, not on the Lord. So don't allow the enemy to distract you. You know, Nehemiah was like, no, we have a task and we're going to do it. I'm going to do it. You can say what you want to say. You want to do what you want to do. I'm going to do what God has called me to do. And kind of in the final of this lesson, you know, notice the building a wall was a good work, as I mentioned earlier in verse 18. As it is. Actually, what the original just says, upon this good. This was a good thing, what they were trying to do. Why was it a good thing to build the walls of Jerusalem? I mentioned before one of the reasons why, on a political and sociological sense, that this will be important. So I'm not going to go into that. But from the spiritual side of things, it was to be a protection of the influence, what comes in. At this point, with the symbol of broken walls and burned gate, everything can come in. There's no filter. There's no restraint. This wall was not built to keep people out, but to actually have control of what comes in and what goes out. And I think when you think of these walls, it's just like in our lives. We need to have walls in our life. Walls not to prevent people and things to come to us, but walls that allow us to have a filter what comes in. So we are in control rather than whatever comes our way gets in. Because as we will see as we kind of go through this, the fact that there were no walls, that there was no gates to prevent the entry and exiting of the people allowed for all sorts of junk and enemies to be already in the city, among the people. That brought a lot of discouragement, a lot of corruption, politically and spiritually. And so for our lives, when we look at this, you know, it's important to have these walls that allow us to filter things in, to allow good things in, and to allow good things to go out. So that our who we are is safe from the world, and it has in its center, as it was in Jerusalem, the temple, the Lord being there. And kind of allowing to have our life built around the temple and starting from there, from the Lord being first and everything goes second. So the good work was the work of investing in the spiritual protection of the nation. And so for our lives, it's always good to have walls at times that allow us to allow good and stop evil. Let's pray.